This week, of course, is Thanksgiving, and tonight we will be coming together to consider the things that the Lord has done and be grateful for these things. And let me begin by telling you something I'm thankful for, even as we start this morning. I am grateful that this sermon will represent the last of the bloviations of the friends of Job. For next week, Lord willing, God himself will speak. So we, bloviations, I think that's a word. All right, bloviatings. In any case, we are here in Elihu's speech. You remember that Elihu is one of the friends of Job who sat quietly and listened to the others yammer on about various things related to Job's situation. Sitting and listening to them, he now stands to speak, and he comes particularly to address what he believes is true, which is that Job has been asserting his innocence falsely and wrongly, and that there is a larger issue, a larger reality to what is taking place around Job. Yet, even so, he argues that although Job has missed the point of God's justice over him, and he's not as righteous as he thinks he is, he, Elihu, does not necessarily get it all right. We will see. Now, I pointed out, you remember, over the last couple of Sundays, that Elihu's speech serves some possible purposes in being included here. It's a very difficult sermon speech to get into the book. It doesn't flow well, it doesn't fit well within the book, but there's a number of reasons why it may be included. And I think the primary one now, as we get to the third part of it, is that Elihu is going to reorient the entire debate. He's turning the attention of Job and his friends away from Job to God. He's turning the attention of the discussion away from the issue involving Job and turning it more towards God, which we think is right. And I think here in chapters 36 and 37, the last two chapters of this speech, that he now makes this turn complete. He now completes this turn in the midst of this speech. And he opens the door, if you will, for God to speak. Not that the Almighty needs an introduction, but in a sense, it's almost as though Elihu comes to orient Job towards listening to God, and rightly so. And so, as I've said a couple of times now, Elihu is, you could picture Elihu as the curtain that goes up before the main speaker, the main actor, comes to the stage. And what we see this morning is that curtain now going up. This is it. This is the curtain going up, and the main character will take the stage in the next part of the book. Now, let me remind you of something that Calvin noted. This will be a repetition from last week. I'm bringing these thoughts from Calvin's sermons on this book. You remember that Calvin preached 159 sermons through this book over the course of 6 months. I mean, literally every day he would preach a part of this book. So from the 146th sermon of this book, chapter 37, he reminds us that we need to remember, as Elihu instructs us, not to challenge God's wise judgments and deeds. We are not in any position to judge how God acts. We are not in any position to judge what his purposes and decrees are, what he intends to do. I know we think we are. I know we think we get to tell God what to do and how to behave and so forth. And we've been like that since the garden. But Calvin is making it clear that one of the things that Elihu is going to say here is, be very careful about attempting to put God in a box, because we don't really understand, in our ignorance, we don't really get the things that God is doing. I mean, I think we do, but we really don't. We don't have eyes to see what God can see in his infinite nature. So Calvin suggests three things that come out of Elihu's speech. Number one, we must ponder the excellency and majesty of God, which can be seen in his works, okay? We must. There are many today who would want to put their hands over their eyes and their ears and ignore the majesty of God as it is visible all around us. But we who know him must be the first to ponder the excellence and majesty of our Creator. But inasmuch as we are ignorant and slow-witted, we must not give only a passing glance at what God sets before us. We must think about it. These things are deep. They require thought. One of the things I despise about so much of the so-called Christianity that exists today is that most people are, in a sense, anti-intellectual. They're against the idea of thinking out these things. It's like, well, I just believe this basic idea and I just go about my business. No, no, no. God has put before us deep things which require thought. They require examination. They require us to pursue them. Yes, we might be ignorant and slow-witted, but we can't just give a passing glance to them. We must diligently pursue what he has made known, especially as those of us who know the word, right? And we must not, at the same time, must be careful not to trust our own intellect and think that we have the ability to make good judgments. The fact is that we, even as born-again, regenerated men and women, we are still struggling with corrupted minds and hearts and wills and emotions that get in the way of us really understanding what it is that God has actually said. And so we must give thought, but we must also be ready and willing to say only what God has revealed is what must be true. We must recognize that. We must see that balance in between those things. Or as I said last week, this is not a journey of self-exploration, but a journey of revelation. It's a journey of understanding what it is that God has made known. What has God revealed? We must explore it diligently. But in the end, we must step back and say, what do you say, O Lord? It's not my opinion that matters. It's not your opinion that matters. There's only one opinion that matters, and that's his. So the Christian life is a journey. Now, I do somewhat despise that term now because it's been taken over by aspects of Christianity where they're now turning the Christian life into a journey, and they actually name their churches that way. I struggle with that. But in a sense, it is true that, yes, the Christian life is a journey. It is a journey for us to grasp the majesty of God. Now, last week I said it's a journey to grasp the wonder of God, but this week I'm changing the word to the word majesty. It is a journey for us to grasp the majesty of God. Let me quote Calvin again. So let us be content to consider, that is to pursue, what we do not understand at the outset of our Christian faith, and let us not be weary in that endeavor. If we have lived for a while in the world and are still learning and have not achieved that perfect, much coveted understanding, meaning of all that God has revealed, let us not lose courage. But let us pursue that endeavor, for we will make great progress if we learn in our lifetime to sense the marvels contained in God's works. We should be a people who see the marvels of God all around us. Our eyes have been opened to that reality. So Elihu here in this speech is turning the attention of the men to God and his ways, particularly as it involves the justice of God, the greatness of God, and the majesty of God. Away from the puny desire of Job to just get an answer to his problems, which is often the way we approach this book, isn't it? Well, we approach the book to get an answer to our puny little problems. But it doesn't have an answer to our puny little problems, because it's not about that. And that's what Elihu is doing, turning to the nature of God is the thing to be sought out. Turning to him, even especially as we suffer. Even especially as we struggle in life. Because it is so easy, isn't it, in our sufferings, to say, oh, woe is me. Look at how much trouble I have. And it all becomes about me. And then it all becomes about me searching for an answer to my problem. But that's not what the Christians should be thinking. The Christians should be thinking, wait a minute, My problems are insignificant compared to the glory and majesty and greatness of the God that I worship. Oh, and by the way, this life and all of its sufferings are temporary. So this is what Elihu is doing, I think. So we've seen so far that in the first chapters of this speech, chapters 33 to 35, Elihu has extolled the justice of God. As we noted last week, God's justice is perfect. God will judge all men for their deeds. No one, including Job, is exempt from examination because every violation of God's law is personal to God. It's a personal affront to his holiness, and so all men will stand before him and be judged. Job's protestations of innocence go too far, Elihu decrees, because God is holy, and Job will be judged like we all will be judged. Now, we know something, of course, that Elihu doesn't know, and that is that Job is righteous by the decree of God. Okay? Now, is Elihu is floundering around the dark, talking about righteousness from the perspective of human behavior. But we know, as we step back from the book, that Job is righteous because, in chapter 1, God declares it to be so. Have you considered my servant Job? That's not an observation. That's a declaration. That is God looking at Job and saying, he is righteous by my decree. It is God himself who has put Job forward as just, and it is God himself who vindicates Job through this event. In other words, the story of Job is a picture of men attempting to grasp God. That's what it is. It's a picture of men attempting to grasp God. Elihu elevates God's justice, and rightly so, but misses that it is God himself who justifies sinners. It is God himself who justifies sinners before that awful justice that he possesses. And we know, of course, that it's done specifically in the work of Christ Jesus. That it is Christ Jesus who has come into the world to make us able to stand against this perfect justice that has come. So as we approach Elihu's final words now in chapters 36 and 37, we must remember to do so through the lens of what we know about God's greatness and majesty. Again, we read this book as those living in the 21st century through the lens of all that God has revealed to us, much of which Job and his friends had no knowledge of, but we do. We understand, and so we must read it through that lens. Now, as I said, the first parts of the speech are a defense of God's justice and a defense of God's greatness, but now we come to a defense of God's majesty. Elihu, first, in chapter 36, will once again go back to his original apologetic and say, I do have a right to speak here, all right? But listen to his words. 36, chapter 2, bear with me a little while and I will show you, for I have yet something to say on God's behalf. I will get my knowledge from afar and ascribe righteousness to my Maker. For truly my words are not false. One who is perfect in knowledge is with you. Elihu claims here to be speaking to Job on behalf of God himself. When he says, I have something yet to say on God's behalf, he believes that his words are from the very mind of God himself. See that? That's what he's saying. I'm speaking on God's behalf, that he can speak for God even as a man. Now, this is an extraordinary assertion, isn't it? I mean, I particularly like the phrase when he says, one who is perfect in knowledge is with you. I'm not sure I would say that ever. But he does. He does. Now, we might assume by reading these words from Elihu that he's being rather braggadocious, that he's being rather arrogant, that he's being rather presumptuous to speak for God, right? We might make that assumption, elevating himself, in fact, as being nearly God-like, right? I will get my knowledge from afar, right? Or my words are not false, or One who is perfect in knowledge is with you. I mean, those are the kinds of phrases that are like, oh, wow. We might assume, wouldn't we, as we listen to Elihu speak like that, that he is being rather braggadocious. However, I would point out that Elihu is young, even by his own testimony, right? And he has, of course, all the immaturities of youth in himself, right? Thinking that because he is young, he is smarter than everybody else in the room. And the fact of the matter is he does overstate his position. But let me suggest that he overstates his position to make a point. You look at these words and you think, wow, what an arrogant man. But what if Elihu is actually doing this? What if Elihu is getting the attention of everybody else listening to him and saying, let me speak as though God were speaking to you. Not as though I'm God, but I'm going to speak as though God is speaking through me. The knowledge of who God is can only come from God himself. Agreed? The knowledge of who God is can only come from him. Because even as we've already discussed in previous chapters of this book, it is not possible for all of us to truly understand the nature of an infinite God. Elihu is wanting Job and his friends to think about all this from God's point of view. That's what he's doing. As I said, he's reorienting the conversation. Let's think about this from God's perspective, not from ours. And so he steps up and says, let me talk to you as though God were talking to you. Turning the conversation away from Job and all of his troubles to the greatness and majesty of God, which is precisely, you remember, the point of the entirety of the book, isn't it? This isn't a book about Job. This isn't a book about Job's friends. This isn't a book about Job's wife. This isn't a book about Elihu. It's not a book about Job's sufferings or what his friends think he's done to deserve these things or how to get out. It's none of those things. What is this book about? In the end, this is a book about God. It's a book about God, for he is the main character in the book. We make the mistake of thinking that because it's named Job, that Job is the primary character. No, Job is one of the characters, a sub-character in the story that is used by the main character to bring about what he desires. This is a book about the nature and glory of God as he reveals himself through persons and circumstances in time and space. You cannot read that heavenly counsel without coming to that conclusion. Otherwise, you are completely blind. This isn't God saying to Satan, I'm just interested to see what you might do with him. That's preposterous. No, God has spoken in order to accomplish something. And so the grander purpose of this book is about him, that is, the Almighty. So Elihu is correct, in essence, to speak for God. He is correct, in essence, to speak for God, to point men away from themselves to the infinite greatness and majesty of God. And that's what the rest of the speech is going to do. To point us away from ourselves to the Almighty. Now, this is the essence of expository preaching. This is the essence of preaching in a way that brings honor to God, to bring a word from the lips of God himself to those who are listening. So as I read those words, I say, well, that's kind of what I'm going to do. Bear with me a little while and I will show you. I have yet something to say on God's behalf. Okay, you wouldn't have any problem with me saying that as a preacher to you, right? I will get my knowledge from afar. Where am I getting my knowledge from? I'm not getting it from myself. I'm getting it from afar. I'm getting it from the mind and heart of God as it comes through his word and ascribe righteousness to my maker. In other words, I'm saying to you, don't listen to me, listen to him. For truly my words are not false. In other words, I'm bringing a word that's true from what God has said in his word. And one who is perfect in knowledge is with you. And that ain't me. The one who's perfect in knowledge that is with you is the Spirit of the living God who empowers the words of the preacher to preach. So you see, none of these words are arrogant. These are words ascribing the reality of what is being said to the Most High. Which is probably the reason why anything other than speaking for God from His Word by the power of the Spirit is not preaching. Okay? It's not. It's not the biblical definition of it. If you're going to a church in order to hear the musings of a man, that's not preaching. That would be precisely this in arrogance. So Elihu says, let me make sure you understand that when I come and speak to you now, as I have been, I am not speaking to you on my behalf. I'm speaking to you on God's behalf. Okay, see what I said at the beginning? This is that turning of the conversation. All right, Job, Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, you all been sitting around talking about yourself. Time's up. We're done with that. Like I said at the beginning, I'm thankful that the musings of men are over, for it is time for God to speak. And what's interesting is you will notice in chapters 36 and 37 as we get into it now, how God seems to even speak in the midst of it. All right? Now, chapter 36, verse 5. Behold, God is mighty and does not despise any. He is mighty in strength of understanding. He does not keep the wicked alive, but gives the afflicted their right. He does not withdraw his eyes from the righteous, but with kings on the throne, he sets them forever and they are exalted. Skip down to verse 13. The godless in heart cherish anger. They do not cry for help when he binds them. They die in youth, and their life ends among the cult prostitutes. He delivers the afflicted by their affliction and opens their ear by adversity. He also allured you out of distress into a broad place where there was no cramping, and what was set on your table was full of fatness. Verse 19. Will your cry for help avail to keep you from distress, or all the force of your strength? Do not long for the night when peoples vanish in their place. Take care. Do not turn to iniquity, for this you have chosen rather than affliction. Here's what Elihu does. Elihu infers again that Job's circumstances are an example of God using suffering to deliver the righteous from their sin. All right, he's making that assertion again. If they're willing to accept his correction. So he's going again, once again, go back to this issue of justice. Job's circumstances, your suffering, poor Job, are an example of God using suffering to deliver you from your sin. When he says things like God is mighty and does not despise any, that he is mighty in strength of understanding, he is saying that God is mighty and great and his character is such that he acts justly all the time. Right? So he's simply repeating what we've already heard up until now. But then he goes further with that when he says he does not keep the wicked alive in verse 6, but gives the afflicted their right. Notice the contrast, right? He does not keep the wicked alive, but gives the afflicted their right. Verse 7, he does not withdraw his eyes from the righteous. Okay, so what Elihu is asserting again is that God's justice works perfectly, especially for the righteous. So he's once again making the argument that God's justice will prevail by virtue of his greatness as God. He will prevail in his justice. He will deal with the wicked as they need to be dealt with. He will deal with the righteous as they are to be dealt with. And what he does in verses 7b through 12, I'm not going to read them all, but he uses the imagery of God placing a king on his throne or deposing a king from his throne. Now, it's ironical the way what Roger read this morning is exactly this of a nation putting themselves a king and Samuel coming to them and saying, shouldn't have done that. That was wicked. You should have let God continue to be your king. But God will forgive you for this and allow you to have a king. But you better keep his law. And the king better keep his law. All right. So The picture that Elihu is painting here is the picture of God placing or deposing kings from their thrones. It's, in some ways, I couldn't help but think of it as I was reading that. I couldn't help but thinking of the similar understanding of Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel chapter 4. Right? Here he stands on the roof of his house and says, ha, 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 look at me. I got everything. The nations of the earth bow down to me. And God says, I laugh at your puniness, and drives him off to act like an animal for the next 7 years. And when Nebuchadnezzar finally escapes from that judgment that comes upon him, notice that's God deposing him from his throne temporarily, Nebuchadnezzar wakes up finally and realizes, wait a minute, it is God who sets kings to rule over the nations. It is God who decides who is going to lead a nation. Really? I thought we got to vote. I mean, isn't democracy all about us choosing our king? No. Because God is sovereign over the nations. He installs kings and he can do with them as he pleases, even as it says in Proverbs 21, verse 1, that he can turn the heart of the king wherever way he wants to. You wonder why the people in Washington act the way they do? It isn't because it's just how humans act. God is judging a nation through them. So I believe. They can either listen and serve him and prosper, verse 11, or they cannot listen and perish by the sword, verse 12. God grants to kings what their behavior towards him deserves. So Elihu is once again regurgitating this idea that God does what he wills with the good and with the wicked, that he deals with both appropriately, even as he does with kings. He sets certain kings, and he deposes other kings, and so forth. Now, as I pointed out last week, this is a very similar argument to Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, right? Because all the way through all those speeches, those men asserted that, well, men get in this life what they deserve. That was the assertion that they made. All these men looked at Job and said, look, you're getting what you deserve. Because that's what happens. In this world, God punishes the wicked and he elevates the righteous. And because you're being punished, well, the obvious conclusion must be, if A equals B and B equals C, then A must equal C. You are guilty of sin. Repent. Confess before the deity and your suffering will go away. Now, as we've discovered, that's the wrong conclusion to a truism, which is that, yes, God will deal with the righteous and the wicked. In fact, even Elihu himself repeats the idea in verse 14 when he says, the godless in heart cherish anger, they die in youth, versus he delivers the afflicted by their afflictions in verse 15. So he's making a very similar argument, which, by the way, is one of the reasons why this speech is so very hard to put into this book. Elihu seems to simply be repeating what his friend, what the other friends of Job have been saying. Even though he's claiming he's saying something different. But it's possible here that Elihu is suggesting to Job that God is, in this situation, using suffering differently than those three men would assert. And that is that he's using suffering to prevent Job from falling into judgment in the future. Even as he asserted back in chapter 33. Okay, Job, yeah. Okay, these men have said to you that the reason you're suffering is because you committed some sin. Go repent of that sin, offer a sacrifice to the deity you're suffering, and go away. Elihu says, uh-uh. No, here's what God is doing. God is putting you in a situation to keep you from falling into the pit. Remember? To keep you from falling into the abyss. So he's using suffering to hold you back, to restrain you from what you might do in the future. In other words, verse 21, take care, do not turn to iniquity, for this you have chosen rather than affliction. It's not that Job is being punished for his past sins, but as a corrective for the future. In other words, Elihu is asserting that God's actions here, meaning preventing Job from falling into sin, are a reflection of his greatness. The greatness of God is so great, he can keep you from falling into sin. That's what he's saying. Right? Now, that sounds rather pedantic, but all right, we have to deal with the speech the way it's written. But now let's go to 36:24. Remember to extol his work of which men have sung. All mankind has looked on it. Man beholds it from afar. Behold, God is great, and we know him not. The number of his years is unsearchable. For he draws up the drops of water, they distill his mist and rain, which the skies pour down and drop on mankind abundantly. Can anyone understand the spreading of the clouds, the thundering of his pavilion? Behold, he scatters his lightning about him and covers the roots of the sea. For by these he judges peoples. He gives food in abundance. He covers his hand with the lightning and commands it to strike the mark. Its crashing declares his presence. The cattle also declare that he rises. Now, I read that whole thing because I'm going to just say this up front. That's going to sound a great deal like God speaking in the next chapter, okay? But it's not God speaking, it's Elihu speaking. Now, Elihu has, I think, similar understandings of what God is going to say, but he's not quite there, as we'll discover. Elihu speaks directly here of the greatness of God, okay? Behold, God is great, and we know him not. The number of his years is unsearchable. This is a great theological statement. If you just read past it, you might miss it. It's a tremendous statement. It's a tremendous statement of the nature of God. God is great, and we know him not. The number of his years is unsearchable. It speaks to two aspects of the nature of God simultaneously in one sentence. Number one, it's an assertion of the infinity of God. I'm going to say the infinity of Yahweh, all right? Let's be clear about what God we're talking about here, all right? The infinity of Yahweh. That his nature is so great as infinite that we, as finite, cannot grasp his nature. We simply cannot. Because there is no end to God, we, who are utterly bounded, cannot grasp him. See, there are no bounds to God. And whenever you try to impose one, he breaks out of them. Because there's no bounds to God. There's no limit to his understanding. There's no limit to his magnitude. There's no limit to his knowledge. There's no limit to his power. There's no limit to his wisdom. There's no limit to anything in the nature of God. We are limited in everything. There's nothing we are not limited in. There's nothing in our nature, in our world, in our thinking, etc., that we are not limited in. Every day, somebody in this race discovers something that has not been known before. Every day. Every day. Scientists make assertions that this is true, and the next day somebody proves it's wrong. It's the way it goes. That's not supposed to be, by the way. Right? Science is never a settled thing. The very definition of science is something that's open to exploration and skepticism. That's the point of science. For a man to stand and look into the camera and say, look, I'm science, listen to me, is a man who is basically saying, I know everything, and he's a fool. So the bottom line is, we are limited in everything, but God is not. There is no limit in the nature of his knowledge, of his magnitude, of his power, etc. And that dichotomy is exactly what Elihu says when he says that we do not know him. God is great, and we do not, and we know him not. We cannot grasp the concept of infinity. You can't. You can try, but you can't. You could go home tonight and take out a piece of paper and start writing a number and just keep adding digits to it and just keep adding digits to it and keep adding digits to it, and you'd never find an end to that number. You would write for the rest of your life because there is no end to it. God is like that. You cannot grasp such a number. I mean, how many of us really grasp the concept of 33 trillion? Back when I was a kid, by the way, there was no word trillion. The word trillion came into existence in the 1980s. In my day, when they talked about, well, what today we call trillions, they had to use millions of millions. Because a trillion is a million million. So the distance to the nearest star to us is approximately 6 million million miles, or 6 trillion mile. Now multiply that by 5 and see if you understand the size of that. You can, right? This is the nature of God. He is beyond our comprehension. As bounded creatures, we cannot grasp him. Our limited nature means we simply cannot fully fathom him, and we never will. All right, make sure you understand this. Even as we go into the presence of God in glory and come before his throne, we will spend literally an eternity trying to grasp the infinity of a God who is greater than we are, period. There are some who say, well, once we die, we just gain all knowledge. No. We will have to continue to explore who this God is. He reveals more and more of himself through all of eternity. And yes, we will understand it with perfect minds and hearts, but the difference is that we will still be learning of him because there's more of him to go. So Elihu makes an assertion of the infinity of Yahweh, but he also makes an assertion of the eternality of Yahweh. See, I thought I had you with the infinity thing, but now let me just make that even more difficult by asserting not only that God is infinitely this way, he's also infinitely this way. He is eternal. He has no beginning. He has no end. His nature is beyond the bounds of time, such that we, who are limited in time, cannot grasp his nature. Yahweh means I am. It's not I was, okay? It's not I will be. It's not, well, I am here. No, it's not limited to now. It is always I am. No matter where you go, God is there. No matter where you go in time, God is there. I like freaking people out with this philosophical analogy. I know I've used it many times, but indulge me in one more time. You have no present, only a past and a future. See, those words are in the past. And so are those. Oh, and so are those. I'll freak you out if you do that long enough, right? You have no present. Everything is moving from the future into the past across your vision. And for a few milliseconds, you have a present, and then it's gone. But for God, he has no past and no future. He's eternally present. He is now. God is seeing this moment now in exactly the same way that he has seen the moment that Christ was born in Bethlehem 2,000 years ago, and when Abraham first stepped into Canaan 2,000 years before that, and Noah stepped out of his ark sometime before that, and so on. It's all right in front of his eyes now. Again. Do you understand that? No, you don't. Because you don't have a present. He has a present, but you don't. God is infinite in nature and eternal in time. We are utterly time constrained. Everything's about time. Some of you are looking at your watch even now. Is he going to stop talking anytime soon? Right? You are time consumed. I got to beat the Methodists to the buffet. Shut up. Sorry, I shouldn't have said that. But you see, we are time-constrained creatures, and therefore, as we try to understand the nature of Yahweh, we just stand there with our mouth hanging open. Because we cannot grasp him. That's Elihu's point. In fact, in 27 to 33, the verses that I read, Elihu uses the imagery of a rainstorm to picture the power and greatness of God. Let me ask you a few questions about the rainstorm. How many raindrops are there in the storm that fell on Baldwin County a few days ago when we got some nice rain? How many raindrops fell? How many raindrops per square foot fell? Do you know? You have no idea. You wouldn't even know how to measure it. The best you could do is put a rain gauge out and it collects some and you kind of take a shot at it. But even then, it's not really accurate, is it? We don't really know. How big will the storm be? How much space will it cover? I mean, we've become pretty good, I will confess, at figuring out where hurricanes are going to go and how big they're going to be, but we still get caught by surprise. Didn't Sally catch us by surprise? Right? Where does the lightning actually come from? Where does it go? Have you ever been near a lightning strike? You ever stood near when one struck the ground nearby? Not too many years ago, Deb and I were driving on a freeway in Kansas, and just as I looked out the window, a lightning strike hit the ground in a field just on the other side of the freeway from where we were. It wasn't more than 100 yards from where we were. Man, you want to talk about a pow. But can you guess where it's going to go next? You have any idea which cloud it came from when it struck the ground? How fast it was going? How much heat it had? All that kind of stuff? No. Even, there's a funny in here, you may not have noticed it, but even the movement of cattle signals his power. Verse 33, the cattle also declare that he rises. You might not notice that because you don't live in a cattle-based society anymore. Well, some of you do, but most of you don't. The cattle get up and move when they know a storm is coming. God has given to cattle an intuitive sense of where to go and hide. Sometimes they make mistakes when they do that, and they go sit under trees and get blasted into oblivion. But they generally know where to move. It's somewhat of a funny that he's making. Even the movement of cattle signals his power. What's the point? A storm is something that we really don't understand. We don't grasp it. It's beyond our comprehension. It's something that happens and we see it. But in terms of actually measuring it and trying to understand exactly how it works, we really don't. But that's the point. And he goes on to say, verse 31, for by these he judges peoples. He gives food in abundance. Although rainstorms can be deadly, they are essential for the growing of crops and the feeding of people. A massive amount of nitrogen is released from the atmosphere into the soil when a thunderstorm goes by. And farmers will tell you, they need that nitrogen. It fertilizes the ground. It's an amazing thing. So Elihu is speaking of the greatness of God. It's beyond our comprehension. But his greatness is the source of life and death. It's the source of mercy and justice. It's the source of salvation and condemnation. What Elihu is saying is, don't ever ignore the greatness of God. As I said, what Calvin said earlier, right? We must examine the things that God has given to us. God has shown us his greatness by the things that are around us, and we should be pursuing our understanding of them, our recognition of them, if nothing else, our recognition of the greatness of God in the world. In other words, what Elihu turns, he says to Job this, he's saying, God is working through your circumstance to accomplish his purposes. He's working through your circumstances to extol his greatness and to demonstrate his power over all things. So here's my advice, Job. Lean into it. Okay? That's what he said. Lean into it. Now, we know, and there's an irony here. And the irony is based on what we know. It's a perfect truth, isn't it? All of what I just said is a perfect truth. All of what Elihu exposes here is a perfect truth, but it's badly misplaced. The unfortunate reality of Elihu is it's badly misplaced. God is not demonstrating his greatness through Job's response. Right? Elihu says, God is great, lean into it, and God will show his greatness in how you respond. Nope. Nope, nope, nope. That's where he gets misplaced. God is not demonstrating his greatness through Job's response. God is demonstrating his greatness in spite of it. God is demonstrating his greatness in spite of how Job responds to what happens. In fact, that's going to be what Job himself admits after God speaks when he says, I'll stop talking now. So Elihu extols the greatness of God, but then he also extols the majesty of God in chapter 37. He moves from the greatness to the majesty. Not much of a difference between those two things. They sound like synonyms, but hopefully you'll see a difference. In verse 1, he says, at this also my heart trembles and leaps out of its place. Hey, Good idea. Keep listening to the thunder of his voice and the rumbling that comes from his mouth. Under the whole heaven he lets it go, and his lightning to the corners of the earth. After it his voice roars. He thunders with his majestic voice, and he does not restrain the lightnings when his voice is heard. God thunders wondrously with his voice. He does great things that we cannot comprehend. And the implication is that with his voice. Now, I want you to have you notice what he just did there. As you cross from chapter 36 into 37, Elihu turns the storm into God himself. See it? He speaks at the end of 36 about a thunderstorm, okay? Imagine a thunderstorm, a typical thunderstorm. Now, he turns and says, God is the storm. God is the storm. So now he turns lightnings and thunderings from just atmospheric events into the very words of God himself. And in verses 6 to 12, which you can read on your own, Elihu describes a number of weather-related events that are all determined by the sovereign God. Snow, cold, downpours, icy weather, frozen storms, etc. Frozen waters and storms, etc. Now, in my ever so humble opinion, the cold nature of this imagery is somewhat contrary to the natural climate that Job would have experienced in southern Canaan. Southern Canaan is warm, arid, desert-like. And so the imagery that Elihu paints here is a bit different than what Job would himself actually experience in normal day-to-day life. And he's probably doing so in order to demonstrate the power of God. You know, God can freeze the Dead Sea over if he wants to. Have to get pretty cold to do it, given its salt content, but he could do it. There are parts of the world where salt water is turned to ice on a regular basis. God can do that. Right? So I think Elihu is simply bringing forth this idea. Look, nothing's impossible with God. He could bring ice storms here in southern Canaan if he wants to. All right. So in verse 13, he notes that these things come either for correction or for his land, meaning what is needed for crops to grow, or just simply because he is full of love, just because he is bountiful. Whether for correction or for this land or for love, he causes it to happen, Elihu says. And in verse 7, Elihu says that all of this is that all men whom he made may know it. That the natural world clearly identifies the reality of a creator God. All right, so Elihu is appealing here to what we call natural revelation. He's appealing here to the idea that the world itself and all the ways that it works demonstrates that there is a creator. The natural world cries out for the fact there's a creator. But then he turns his attention specifically to the voice of God. You see it in verse 2, 4, and 5. And Elihu makes this assertion. God's voice is the power of his majesty. God is majestic in every other way, as I earlier articulated. But when you get right down to it, the real majesty of God comes out of his voice. His thunderings, as Elihu puts it. As God speaks, both the power of his speech and the content of his words demonstrate his majesty. Our God is not just majestic because he is infinite and eternal. He is also majestic because he speaks. You cannot read the 66 books of this Bible without coming to the conclusion that everything that brings glory to God comes by his words. You can't even get past the first few verses of the book of Genesis, and you already have it. And God said, "Let there be light." He didn't create it by grabbing something and making it. Nope, he simply spoke it. and it came into being. By the way, just so you know, I had a physicist, I listened to a physicist many, many years ago who argues that when it says God said, let there be light, given the fact that all actual matter is formed from light itself, light energy is the very substance of all atomic material, all the subatomic particles are actually bits of light. When God said, let there be light, he was creating all of the elements of the universe at that moment. He flung them into existence. His voice. So you think about all the places where God has spoken to display his power in creation. He spoke his law into existence. He spoke the scriptures into existence, right? And probably the greatest speaking of God is the Word made flesh who dwelt among us. God speaks. Even the preaching of the gospel, we're told, brings faith through hearing. We hear the Word as God speaks to the preacher to produce faith and salvation in the life of the one who hears. And you will also note, with no small amount of irony, that God himself will speak in the next chapter and put this entire event to rest. Now, I'm going to make a caveat next week about this discussion between natural revelation and special revelation. As we will see it, it's something I've been holding. I dare say I've been biting my tongue on this for quite a few chapters. Lord willing, maybe he'll let me live long enough to be able to tell you what I'm thinking. Now, go to verse 14 of chapter 37. Hear this, O Job. Stop and consider the wondrous works of God. Do you know how God lays his command upon them and causes the lightning of his cloud to shine? Do you know the balancing of the clouds, the wondrous works of him who is perfect in knowledge? You whose garments are hot when the earth is still because of the south wind. Can you, like him, spread out the skies hard as a cast metal mirror? He turns to Job and asks a fundamental rhetorical question. Do you really understand the ways of God? You think you do. You claim that you do. You've been sitting here asserting before Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar that you know the ways of God, but do you really? Now, by the way, the sniff test against these verses is that they're going to sound a great deal like God in the next chapter, because God's voice is going to be a whole lot of rhetorical questions, very similar. But that's the point. If God can do all these things, who are you to question his ways? If God is just and mighty, who are you to demand answers from God? We've spoken about this in the past, right? We don't have the right to tell God how he ought to operate. We don't have the right to tell God, look, you can't give me cancer. You can't take away all my money. You can't do that. And God says, want a bit? How dare you question me? In fact, now that you question me, I'm going to make it even worse. You get that feeling sometimes? I don't think God is like that, but sometimes we wonder, right? Job did. So, if God could do all these things, who are you to question him? If God is just and mighty, who are you to demand answers from God? Which leads him then to these verses, 21 to 24. You know, I'm too far ahead. 21. And now no one looks on the light when it is bright in the skies, when the wind has passed and cleared them. Out of the north comes golden splendor. God is clothed with awesome majesty. The Almighty, we cannot find him. He is great in power, justice, and abundant righteousness. He will not violate. Therefore, men fear him. He does not regard any who are wise in their own conceit. To claim wisdom of your own is to be ignored by God, Elihu says. Our wisdom must come from God as he reveals it. We cannot make it up as we go. It's something he must reveal to us. You will notice what Elihu does is, even as he gets to the end of the speech, he has turned this discussion entirely at this point away from Job, away from himself, and entirely to God. God's majesty is the imagery of boundless wisdom, absolute power, and perfect justice overall, and no one should ever presume upon God's majesty. We must live as a people who are always whelmed by it. Now let's consider Elihu's speech then. Elihu's speech does turn us toward the nature of God, as we will see next. It's away from ourselves and towards Him, as He extols His own nature in the world. God will extol His own nature in the world in the next chapters. And rightly so, because this is what the book is about. But as we stop and consider Elihu's speech, even as we ponder over all of the speeches that have been given so far, the Christian life, we recognize, is a journey to grasp the majesty of God. You really, by now, should see it clearly. This has been a journey through this book. At the beginning of the book, poor Job sitting on a hill, his wife tells him to curse God and die. His reaction in chapter 3 is to lament the fact that he was even born. But now, by the time you get to this point, you have a man saying, it's not about you. It's never been about you. It's about God. See it? I hope you've seen it. As we've gone through 37 chapters of this book, I hope you realize as we've gone through 35, 36 chapters of speeches here, right? A journey that has taken place of men who started off with simplistic and naive ways of thinking and have now graduated all the way to this point of like, look, the answers here are not found in us. They're not found in our situation. They're not found in our answers to our problems. They're found in the greatness of God. See? So it makes logical sense that God would step up to the microphone next. God is so great that we simply cannot fathom His greatness. We cannot fathom His perfections, His majesty, and His infinity. We cannot grasp the fullness of God, but here's what we know in the 21st century. We know that God has condescended to make Himself known to us. God has come to us and revealed Himself to us. We may not yet grasp the fullness of His greatness. We may not grasp the fullness of His majesty, but He has come to us. And He's come to us as a man. He's come to us in the form of a man. His own nature in His Son, who has come down to this world and He has spoken to us. So my friends, as we enter into the Christmas season, we enter into the season in which we celebrate the incarnation of the Son. And we begin that season with a time of thanksgiving for all that God has done for us. In anticipation of that incarnation, of celebrating that incarnation, we are reminded again that to grasp the wonder of God is to look fully into the face of Christ. To look into the face of Christ Jesus. To hear the words of God Himself from the lips of Jesus and to see the glory of God in Him. And to pursue in Him the wonder of the triune God. Through faith in His promises and the righteousness that He gives us, you see. Elihu is absolutely right. We cannot grasp the majesty of God. We cannot even fathom it. But God sent His only begotten Son into the world in order that He might show us what He wants us to understand. Even as John the Apostle wrote the prologue of his gospel, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen His glory. Glory as the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. For from His fullness we have all received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses, meaning that shadow was given through Moses. Grace and truth, the abundance of God's knowledge, came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God. The only God who is at the Father's right hand, He has made Him. No. We come to understand the greatness of God simply by looking into the face of our risen Savior.